In my infamous past, I was in charge of human subjects at the Department of Energy, which is how I came to this issue, and had a lot of concerns for how we went about dealing with workers and studies in the workplace, which I still have, by the way. I would like to introduce Ken Silver, who put this whole session together. Ken is an assistant professor of environmental health at East Tennessee State University, also a charming soul. He has worked with the DOE worker population since the mid-1990s as a doctoral student at Boston University School of Public Health, and now from his perch in Tennessee. Ken?
Thank you very much, Susan. Thank you all for coming, and I especially want to thank the panelists who rolled with a bit of uncertainty and are all here prepared and to share their expertise and accomplishments with you in this area. I'm happy to argue against genetic susceptibility testing. There have been a few significant developments since this panel was planned. First, you may have heard the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, GINA, passed Congress earlier in the spring. Secondly, the science has progressed in elucidating the molecular mechanism of action that's related to susceptibility markers identified in worker populations. And I'll let you judge the significance of what we've been doing at ETSU, conducting research on what DOE employees at Los Alamos and Oak Ridge know, what they believe, and what they feel about genetic susceptibility testing. Those developments have forced my views to evolve a bit since Rich Sharp and I submitted our formal abstract for today. He's now at the Cleveland Clinic. We did some writing and thinking about the potential uses of the GLU69 marker in voluntary testing programs. As Lou said, the marker has low specificity. About 30% of beryllium workers unaffected have the marker. It has moderate to high sensitivity. We felt what mattered most was the positive predictive value. The likelihood that an individual from an exposed population will go on to develop the disease given a positive result on the screening test. We also concluded that if employers were to offer the test, even in a voluntary confidential program, it would strongly imply that workers ought to go get tested and perhaps shift the locus of responsibility for a safe and healthy workplace more onto the backs of employees. We were also concerned that those who test negative might pay less attention to industrial hygiene when working with beryllium. And finally, because one of the voluntary employer-sponsored pilot programs was at Los Alamos National Lab, we couldn't ignore the elephant in the room. Susan knows what I'm talking about. The history of disrespect for workers' health concerns and bodily integrity at many DOE facilities. But it's the positive predictive value that's the most important property for a test in a voluntary program, because it does the most to facilitate autonomous decision-making. It depends on a number of different parameters: how many people in the population have the genetic marker, the prevalence of disease, as Lou pointed out. But a couple of salient cases from the Weston paper: if the disease frequency is 5%, the positive predictive value can be as high as 14. Increase the disease frequency, you're getting up to almost the more likely than not predictive value. What is new? Dr. Weston gave a talk in Tennessee where he enlightened us to the fact that there are some very rare forms of the gene where the positive predictive value is almost 100%. You heard that right. The rare individual with that rare form of the gene who's exposed to beryllium would almost certainly become sensitized or develop CBD. Another major development from Dr. Weston's group are some recent computational chemistry studies of how beryllium binds to the protein product of this gene. It really is a coherent and compelling mechanistic model to explain the findings of these marker studies in worker populations. What else is new? The Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, signed in spring of 2008, Title I covers insurance, but only health insurance and group health plans. It is silent on long-term care, life insurance, or disability insurance. Title II addresses employment. As you can see, the same prohibitions on gathering and using genetic information that apply to employers also apply to unions, employment agencies, and apprentice programs. So at ETSU, we've been trying to get at two big questions, to test or not to test, and if yes to testing, then how would workers like to see it done? That's Kevin Kline playing Hamlet. So with funding from the Center to Protect Workers' Rights, under whose cooperative agreement with NIOSH, we received the small project grant, and a host of talented collaborators in academia, the community, and labor groups, my talented co-investigator, Gary Kukulka, who's a health educator and extraordinary facilitator, held five focus groups with beryllium-exposed workers and family members. Our last one was held in Knoxville in the spring, just before Gina passed. It's considered de rigueur in the literature of the knowledge, beliefs, and attitudes around genetic tests to include the first degree relatives of the person who's being tested. They may share the same genes, and they have to make family decisions. So we did that in all three of our outings in New Mexico and Tennessee. I gained access to this worker population when I lived in New Mexico from 97 to 03. I became active on the Campaign for the Compensation Act. Bill Van Buskirk gave me permission to use his image and story in this work. He developed borreliosis in the 1970s and experienced every injustice imaginable. As we got to know each other, he and his wife, Barbara, expressed hope for genetic technologies being used to prevent this problem in the future. I was the big skeptic. They've since moved to Washington State, but after years of public meetings, op-ed pieces, grassroots organizing, the community of Los Alamos beryllium workers who know Bill's story and have a few of their own let us in to do this study. You'll recognize David Michaels in the foreground. That's the day in March 2000 when Senator Jeff Bingaman found his voice and became the chief sponsor of the Compensation Act. Ethnicity is a very big issue in this part of the country. Espanola, where we held our focus groups, is in Rio Arriba County. Most of the residents are Hispanic or Native American. The orange areas are Indian tribes. Los Alamos, where they work, is on the hill. There's been a caste-like system of employment, with Native New Mexicans more likely to work in menial, clerical, and administrative positions under Anglos who came from somewhere else with a PhD degree. Rio Arriba County, where Espanola is, has huge economic and health disparities compared to Los Alamos. I bring this up because Sheldon Samuels, who's devoted a big part of his career to the issue of genetic testing, had an interesting paper in Environmental Health Perspectives in 1996. He painted a grim scenario of inappropriate use of genetic testing leading to caste-like exclusions of people who happen to be related to each other from certain occupations. If that scenario has a chance to play out anywhere, New Mexico would seem to be a likely place. So we carried out a recruitment plan through labor and advocacy groups, got 21 people to participate in three focus groups in New Mexico, administered a brief demographic questionnaire. As you can see, the majority were Hispanic males, on average middle age, 15 years since first exposure to beryllium. And the vast majority had a high school education. Rich Sharp, with his incisive thinking on these issues, helped us develop some good guideline questions for the focus groups. They locked me, the subject matter expert, in a glass booth. I did not participate. I observed. We were interested in six key issues. Who should or shouldn't sponsor a voluntary testing program? Where should it take place? Can anything related to the workplace be voluntary, or is there always an element of coercion? What about confidentiality in a voluntary program? Are people going to brag that they're negative or self-disclose to their employer? How would workers respond to a negative test or to a positive test? And the sixth issue of greatest interest to me is what Lou emphasized. Positive predictive value with a disease prevalence of about 5% is 14%. So does a genetic test tell workers something they don't already know? Is there really that big a difference from knowing that the prevalence in your occupation is 5%, you take the genetic test, it goes up to 14? Is this valuable for autonomous decision making? So we analyzed the New Mexico focus group transcripts using in vivo software, and I'll present according to that outline, but let me cut to the chase. Here are several points gleaned from the focus group transcripts which support the arguments against genetic testing, my assigned topic today. You'll see the evidence against genetic testing in a yellow typeface, but I wanted you to see the full breadth of what they've been telling us, and if it doesn't support the case against, it's not in yellow. When they check you for sensitivity, what's the difference between that and genetics? Good question. Some of the workers asked the questions that scientists are asking. Is a group of people working together with beryllium? Maybe only four get sensitized. Is there an explanation for that? I didn't ask him if he wanted to go to grad school, but those are the very questions that scientists are asking. People's knowledge was all over the place. We have no idea of what a genetic test is, another experienced employee said. Some drew on popular culture to try to get a handle on DNA. It's like CSI. You see it on TV. And after hearing the uneven levels of knowledge in the group, a union steward began to emphasize that education ought to be the number one priority. There was some confusion over a heritable genetic marker versus genotoxicity. One person was quite clear, but others were confused. Genotoxicity passed on to your children is not what we're talking about, and as best I know, is not an issue for beryllium. What are some of the benefits of a genetic test in their view? Most of them centered on the potential for autonomous decision-making, knowledge is power, find another trade, do something else. Former workers who are already sensitized felt some remorse that they didn't have a genetic test, and they felt they would have gone into a different career. If they were offered the test today, they would take it and advise their children to do something else. What's the downside of having a voluntary genetic susceptibility test? Family mental anguish was often cited. There was concern that blood collected in a voluntary program might be diverted to checking for other markers, and workers expressed suspicion that this was already happening in some of the research and medical surveillance programs that they volunteered for. Additional burdens were identified, threats to insurability, something called the Superman syndrome. Those who test negative might think they don't need to follow industrial hygiene practices. And lack of accountability for contractors who've run DOE facilities was the source of much skepticism about whether you could enforce any confidentiality guidelines that are developed as part of a voluntary program. The threat of adverse actions by employers is maybe less important now that GINA has been adopted. One retired construction worker expressed the view that discrimination would not be a great problem because alternative employment opportunities are supposedly abundant at national laboratories. They've always got a job for you. So what would increase the likelihood or decrease the likelihood of individuals pursuing testing? Well, privacy was a huge concern. Los Alamos is a company town. They all talk to one another when something like this comes up. We heard both at Oak Ridge and Los Alamos about a special program that people who do high-risk work related to national security are eligible to enroll in voluntarily, where they agree to allow the employer to have wide-ranging access to medical, personal, and financial information. When we checked with DOE headquarters, they said they never heard of this program, that all workers who get a security clearance are covered by uniform regulations for employer access to records. But we were told at Oak Ridge that they get an extra $2 an hour if they waive additional privacy rights. So we need to learn the name of that program. There are also concerns based on workers' experience with the LPT testing program and the medical removal protection benefit provisions of the DOE beryllium standard, as well as garden variety workers' comp. People who go on light duty, co-workers will give him guff. If people remove themselves based on their genetic status. There were concerns about the ability of scientists in the testing program to maintain confidentiality, whether the judiciary would say give up the testing result in the context of tort litigation. federal agencies with intelligence capabilities. Don't laugh. The FBI really is responsible for background checks for people getting security clearances. And then interlocking relationships between the private sector and insurers. Most people felt it should be offered on a voluntary basis. There was a minority point of view that it should be mandatory, but that's moot in light of the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act. One construction worker felt that there should be paid time to go get tested. Who should pay for it? There was overwhelming sentiment that the employer should be completely separated from such a testing program. One way not to do it was informed by the last comment. Workers experienced with a drug testing program don't have a mobile van that goes to the work site. The workers refer to that as the paddy wagon. Have it done off-site. The credibility and independence of scientists involved was a concern. So who would be credible? Here are some of their ideas. Have more than one group involved so that no one testing group would be subject to undue influence. The CDC should have a role. A watchdog group. One construction worker has a warm place in his heart for environmentalists because he's noticed that they can't be bought. He felt they should be involved. And the idea for a joint labor management safety board chaired by a union business agent was also proposed. In light of GINA, it might have to be more of a consortium with university and government folks involved. I'll skip over some of the family issues to get to the question of positive predictive value. Does this test tell me something I don't know? You know you've got a 5% chance based on prevalence alone. You get the test, and they tell you it's 14. Well, most of the workers rejected the very premise of the question. They did not agree that the prevalence is only 5%, you know, despite what the literature says. We got only one really well-informed answer based on someone who may have had an occasion to think about it before. In his view, if it goes from 5% to 14 or 15%, that's so important. And like a good trade unionist, his immediate focus was on upping the control levels rather than removing the sensitive individual. So here are the arguments against from the voices of workers and their family members. There hasn't been enough education to date. There will be de facto violations of privacy because there's no accountability in DOE communities. We were unable to identify a consensus on who should sponsor, where it should take place. There are still threats to insurability. GINA doesn't cover life, disability, and long-term care insurance. GINA is also silent on discoverability in private tort litigation. No policies on self-disclosure in a voluntary program. I didn't want to call it medical removal. At the risk of thinking you wandered into a seminar on adolescent health, people would be removing themselves from the workplace for preventive reasons. And this catchy term, the Superman syndrome. And we had some great help from Professor Hilario Romero at Northern New Mexico Community College. If you think you have something to offer people in Northern New Mexico in your work, get in touch with him. We were able to go back last summer and hold an educational forum thanks to a private contribution made to our research foundation by a worker who received compensation. So that's what I have to say. Thank you. Thanks.
You convinced me. That was really great. Thank you. Our next speaker is Jeff Lomax, who works on developing ethical guidelines.